Today is the 30th of October 2007. I'm continuing the interview with Frank Jennings. Frank, we were talking about Menzies, and there's a couple more questions I'd like to ask about your time with Menzies. Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm wondering about his attitude to conscription for the Vietnam War. Now, you know, we know his political view on that, but mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether, not so much the Vietnam War itself, but the fact of conscription for overseas service.
Yeah, the ballot system.
Yeah, that ballot they had. Whether informally Menzies had ever indicated an attitude to you?
Not really. Although being the government position, I'd say he accepted that they didn't want to conscript everybody of a particular age, and they felt that the ballot system was probably as fair as any in determining who should be pulled into the services. I know conscription's got a very bad reputation, as it should have, in Australia's history. But I think the ballot system was what the government would have thought was as fair a means as they could think of to get the numbers of troops they reckon were necessary.
Did he ever talk about the war itself to you?
No, not that I can recall. I mean, we probably did on what was happening on a day-to-day basis, and you know, in terms of election campaign and the need to strengthen the defence, and I think we were looking at F-111s at that stage for the RAF, which were on the drawing board, and you know, there was occasionally this sort of conversation about the need to be prepared, but fairly general conversations. We never had any really hard policy discussions on those sort of things.
And, you know, this was also a time where a political movement developed in opposition to the war and opposition to conscription. And this leads me to think about security at Old Parliament House. What was the security arrangement like, especially for the Prime Minister?
The Prime Minister did have strong views about not having, not being seen to have police or protective services all around him. His attitude there was, look how many American presidents have been killed with all the Secret Service agents they have around you. An American president doesn't move without a dozen or 20, you know, security people hanging around him and around his car. But Menzies felt that that was only attracting attention and giving a challenge to the, you know, would-be assassins. And a couple of times he made this sort of comparison with American presidents lost and Australia had lost none. So he didn't want any security about at all. But there was during his time, I don't know what branch, I guess it was the Federal Police, did put an officer here, like a sergeant level or something here. And I forget his name now, but the chap I'm thinking of, had been in Hong Kong, and he'd worked in Hong Kong, and he had some fancy tales to tell, but he used to hang around in the office outside where Alf Stafford and Chidge sat with their little telephone exchange, and just see that the coast was clear for the PM as he was coming and going. But I think this might have happened after an incident that occurred when, at the time, Menzies used to not come into Parliament through the front door. He would park on the side of Parliament House, and get out of his car there and walk through one of the ground floor offices, which was Athol Townley's office, the Minister for Defence. And he just walked through there and then up the stairs to his own office. And one day, as he was going out for lunch on that track, a fairly large man just popped out from behind the holly trees that are there, and you know, sort of started asking questions about why he couldn't get a job. And he said, "Go up and see Frank." So he directed him up to me, and I had a talk to him and directed him to Social Security or the employment people at the time. And I thought that was the end of it. He was he was agitated sort of person, Central European. I went on holidays a few weeks later, and I was surprised to see that this same person, I think it was a Yugoslav, had poured petrol on himself and set himself alight in Marnica, which made us very concerned then about the type of person that had easy access to the Prime Minister. You know, he might have not been a person just interested in getting a job. He could have been a person, you know, out to get the PM, and there would be nothing there to stop him. So I think it may have been after this incident that there was a little bit of security, but I'd say minimal, you know, one officer. And I've seen sort of reports too later that, you know, people couldn't understand why Harold Holt didn't have security people all around him. But then that's for a comment later on.
Okay. With Menzies, you've said that he would come in from the side. But we're on the east side, aren't we, here in the deputy speaker's...
I think that's right, yes.
Room. So he'd enter from the east side here, go up through Athol Townley's, past Athol Townley's room. Was that a regular routine? Like, was he a man of routine?
That was regular. I mean, if anyone sort of anyone around the house knew that was his routine. I mean, there was no attempt to hide that on security grounds. Yeah.
And he would be driven here?
Driven here, yes. Ray Coppin, I think, was his driver at the time. I think Ray was the driver at that stage.
I've heard of Ray. We're hoping to record him.
Yes, I think Ray was the driver at that stage, and he would drop him off there, and then I would, when he was ready to go for lunch, when the PM was ready to go for lunch, I'd just check out the window to make sure Ray was in position before the PM left his office and walked down the stairs to... and then back through Townley's office to his car.
And then when Menzies would come up to the office, what would happen? Would he go into his room via the work area?
He'd come through where there was there's a box there for the house attendants just outside the PM's office, and then just as you walk into the suite, the Prime Minister's suite, you've got the little area where Alf Stafford and Shidji were, the attendants, cabinet attendants, and PM and cabinet attendants, on the left-hand side. He would turn to the right, and there was a door straight into his office. The passageway to the right led to his office on the left-hand side, and the anteroom and the cabinet office on the right-hand side.
When he would enter, would he greet everybody? Was he?
Oh, yes. Good morning, and you know that was about it. Yeah. Good morning, Alf, Chidge. Hi, Frank. Yeah, no.
So again,
or Frank or Laddie.
Laddie, yes. Mentioned that. Yeah.
Oh, yes. We were always greeted pleasantly in the mornings.
In your position, were you ever asked by third parties to approach the Prime Minister with grievances or requests? Or...
Well, yes. At that stage, people would often come just into King's Hall and go to the attendance box and say, I want to see the Prime Minister. And the attendants were told not to, don't reject anybody, give me a ring. And I wouldn't refuse to see anybody. I would go down, I would tell Alf that I'm out, and I'd tell my girls down here not to put any phone calls through. I would go to King's Hall and see who it was and what their request was. And of course, if they just arrived at Parliament House and wanted to see the PM, that was never on. And often they were people who were looking for wanting employment or wanting financial assistance or something or other, and often they were a bit mentally disturbed. And my practice was to sit on, there are these little triangular benches in the corner of King's Hall up against the columns, and I would indicate to the attendants that I'll be sitting over in that corner. Would you just keep an eye on me? I mean, this is a bit of protection for me, I thought, with some of these people. And, you know, generally I found you could pacify them or convince them that they should go elsewhere. I remember one of the more bizarre cases was a middle-aged woman who said she wanted to see the PM because her Arab boyfriend had left and gone by ship back to Egypt. And she'd heard that HMAS Anzac, I think a destroyer, was in the Indian Ocean, and would the PM get the destroyer, divert the destroyer to this passenger ship, pick up her man and bring him back to Australia where he belonged. It took me a little while, but I had to convince her that Anzac was on a particular mission and on a timetable and couldn't be diverted. And that perhaps she should wait until the man gets to Egypt and then try to contact him. But, you know, that was one of the more bizarre cases.
Would you speak to her in King's Hall or invite her to the office?
No, never to the office. Never. Too close to the PM's room. Mm. My office was just outside the PM's room. Never in the office. I would only speak to these people in King's Hall. Mm. And I was always grateful that the attendants were there and quite willing to keep an eye on things just in case they did erupt, because a few of them were a little bit desperate about work and lack of cash and all that sort of thing. I was never quite sure what sort of reaction I would get. But most of them were passive. Most of them were passive and with a bit of explanation, realised they couldn't just get in and see the PM.
Did the attendants ever have to become involved?
No, never, fortunately. But it was, for my comfort, it was good to know that they were there.
And were you ever given any basic training yourself in how to defend yourself in a situation like that? Or?
Not as such. You know, personally, I'd done a bit of boxing and judo and stuff, but in earlier years. No basic training in that sort of area.
Can we keep talking about Menzies up to his retirement? But I don't want to rush ahead. I mean, if there's anything important prior to the retirement that you want to talk about, now's an opportunity.
I can't think of anything, you know, off the top of my head that really comes to mind. I think we've pointed out how different the situation was in terms of staffing the Prime Minister's office then as against now, that it was really an administrative paper shuffling, prioritising job, and there was nothing like the senior private secretary making decisions or bouncing other ministers or other people's staff or getting involved in the politics. It was really a facilitating role. And some of the people in my position played it more personally by getting involved with the PM's private life at home and so on, which I tried to avoid for my own purposes and for their purpose, I thought. No, I can't think of anything specifically that I would want to say that I haven't that we haven't covered in relation to the PM.
Because it's interesting that to me, as you told me previously, that you were aware that Menzies was going to retire quite some time before he.
2.5 years beforehand. Alan Brown knew that he was the PM had set a date for retirement, there was no reason to believe that that date wouldn't be met. It wasn't known publicly, it wasn't pushed publicly, but when it was coming up January 66. My custom was, because parliamentary area was slack over the Christmas break, it was a time for some of us to take our holidays, and as I had, you know, 3 or 4 young kids at the time, it was generally seen that, you know, I could take holiday break in the school holidays, while the others that didn't have kids would stay on deck and over that period and take their holidays at another time. When I knew that in December 65, and I knew that over that holiday period Menzies was going to retire, I said, well, you know, do you want me to not put my holidays aside, or would you like me to come back early for your retirement time? No, laddie. No, you take the kids on holidays. We'll handle that. We'll look after that. That's not a problem. So, you know, he was, you know, quite conscious of the family situations, and there was no panic, no need to have everyone on deck. And I think at the time it was probably a pretty simple sort of exercise with a press conference and no great fuss and bother, but then the media wasn't as active as it is today. Well, maybe I should give some indication of his reaction to the media at the time.
Please.
He didn't hold many press conferences. When he did, they were only held not on a weekly basis or a regular basis for journalists to shoot questions at him. They were only held when he had something he wanted to say and wanted to tell the nation, whether it be in the economic, international, or defence field or whatever. So it would be only when there was a major sort of issue that he wanted to to get into the public arena. The press gallery journalist would come down into his office, which was larger than it is now, the office, and stand around while he sat. They would stand in front of his desk. At the end, it would have been Tony Eagleton, the press secretary, would have been by the PM's side. And I would be there in case there was a need to grab any documents to help him answer any of the questions. So we would be in the background, Tony and I. But he would, particularly people like, you know, Ian Fitchett, is one that comes to mind that used to have a bit of fun with, or the PM would have a bit of fun with him at times. But he wasn't keen on the media at all, and certainly not keen on television. Which was, well, it had only come in, what, in 1956.
Yep.
But he was not keen to go on television, certainly not in any interview situation, but only, I think, towards the end he went on a few occasions and, you know, delivered a grandfatherly address to the nation type thing. He didn't like technology. He didn't like mics and things like that. didn't particularly like using the telephone. And certainly when they put scramblers in on the, like security scramblers on the phone system, he wasn't too keen on that, and, you know, having to push another button or switch another switch if he wanted to talk some classified conversation with one of his senior officers or someone from Foreign Affairs or something like that. So technology was something he didn't appreciate at all. Say the media thing was he was in control and he was going to stay in control, and he wasn't going to be dictated to by the press gallery into having regular sessions where they just quizzed him on policy. And once we get onto Harold Holt's time as Prime Minister, I can perhaps explain some of the differences there that came in pretty quickly.
One other question about Menzies' retirement. Why do you think he retired?
I think he'd felt that he'd had enough and it was time for some private life. He was 71 and he'd had, 19 years as Prime Minister in a couple of sessions. And I think he thought, you know, sort of his time for a spell, and to get a bit more time with family. I'm not aware of any health issues that would have brought that sort of feeling on, but no, I think he just felt that he'd had enough. I don't think it was anything more than that, and I think he felt that probably that the country was running well at that stage. In that post-war period, unemployment levels, if you got unemployment at 1%, you were almost out of government. You know, 0.5% were unemployable, and if you couldn't employ the other 0.5%, you were not doing the right thing. there was plenty of things post-war to employ people.
Yes.
And certainly economics was not his pet subject. he was much happier, more in the foreign affairs and international and defence areas and things like that, and social areas, than he was with economics.
After Menzies retired, did you see him again?
No, I didn't. He went to Melbourne, and Hazel Craig went to Melbourne as his secretary. No, I didn't. A few Christmas cards and things like that for a while, but apart from that, no, I didn't see him in Melbourne at all.
Can we move on to Harold Holt now, because you remained senior private secretary to Holt?
Right. When Harold Holt became Prime Minister, he wanted to, my supposed contract, we didn't have a contract, but the commission I was given was to stay until Menzies retired. And then when that had happened, I'd been there for, 2.5 years, and I thought it was time for me to go back to the department and get back into the swim of the public service and not miss out on your promotional opportunities within the public service. And but when Harold Holt wanted to bring with him the senior private secretary he had as treasurer, who was Jim Short, a treasury officer, Jack Bunting, who is now head of Prime Minister's Department, thought this wouldn't be a good idea, because there was Well, the grunts and groans that come from the private secretaries back to the department are often pretty valuable. And if the PM's grunts and groans were going to go to Treasury rather than Prime Minister's department, there was this rivalry between the two departments. And I think Jack felt that he should try to persuade, the only way he could persuade Holt not to bring Jim Short was to convince him that I should stay on, because Holt knew me from our previous relationship when I was parliamentary liaison officer, and we got on well together, and he accepted my capacity to handle the parliamentary stuff and so on. So there was Jack Bunting convinced Holt to keep me on, because on the grounds that I would have direct access to the senior officers in his new department, in Prime Minister's department, and if he wanted anything particular to follow up on any paperwork he had, I was in a position to, say, hey, Jack, PM wants this, which is a situation you wouldn't necessarily have from someone whose previous contacts have been with Treasury. So I think this was the basic argument that Jack Bunting used to convince Holt to keep me on. When Holt moved into the office, he called me in, and we had about a 2-hour chat. And he said, "Things are going to be different, Frank. Things are going to be different around here. I'm not Menzies. I'll do things my way, and they'll be different." And that's okay, that's all understandable. Each new leader wants to swing his clean broom and do things his way to make his own name. So that was fine, but a lot of the changes that were made were in relation to the media. I mean, Holt was interested in using the media more, promoting himself through the media more, and particularly as he had Tony Eagleton, he kept Tony Eagleton on as press secretary, and Tony was quite happy to cooperate with the PM in changing the old fuddy-duddy diplomatic sort of way of Alan Browns and Buntings and people like that into something more vibrant, perhaps. And there was to be regular press conferences where the press could ask the PM questions on a broad range of issues, which certainly raised the PM's image and publicity that he got in the media, because the press were able to quote directly from the PM. But to me, as one of the old time, brought up in with some of these old fuddy duddies in Prime Minister's department, the diplomatic type people, it didn't lead to good administration, because I remember one particular case that just illustrates the situation. There was a little Fijian girl, Nancy Prasad. Name sticks with me. There'd been a number of, I'm not too sure about the parents. I think one of her parents was Fijian and the other one was Australian. And there was an immigration issue, and she was supposed to be deported back to Fiji. There had been questions to the Minister for Immigration, it got to the stage, once these conferences came to the PM, the PM was asked questions about Nancy Prasad and the immigration issues involved. And from that point on, once the PM sort of made a statement about it, he didn't say, "Oh, that's a matter for my Minister for Immigration, talk to him." He took the issue up and made a comment. And from then on, all the correspondence to the government on Nancy Prasad came to the PM rather than the Minister of Immigration. Questions in the House went to the PM rather than the Minister. And Holt didn't sort of push these aside and push them back to his minister. Now, that was one case where it added to the administrative load on the Prime Minister completely unnecessarily, and the way I saw it, sort of was undermining the authority of his ministers. Anyway, that was one case that I think shows some of the changes that were pretty immediate when Holt came to power. In relation to the media, Tony Eagleton was a different type of press secretary in that he didn't do his work around the non-members bar. He sat in his office and he was a non-drinker, and if the media wanted to ask questions, they came to him. He would then go to the PM and provide them with the answers. So this was not the style that you perceive as a press secretary those days, but it was an effective way of dealing with the media. They soon got used to it, it got to a stage where even simple little questions were asked by the media, and they would. Tony would chew up the PM's time in getting answers. I remember one, the PM had flu one day and he was staying at the lodge. Tony was away for some reason or other, and Mary Newport, is his secretary and assistant, was on duty. And someone asked her a question about what was the colour of the T-shirt that the PM was wearing when Ivor Hill or someone painted him on the beach at Portsea. And Mary came round to my office and said, I've got to ring the lodge. I've got to talk to the PM to get an answer to this press question. I said, what's the question? And she told me. I said, don't you dare ring the lodge. It's not on. But this is adds colour to the story. I mean, the press need it. And this is what the PM wants. The PM wants to get all these little colour stories in. It's good for him. I said, the PM's sick. If he's too sick to come to the office, he's too sick to talk about the colour of the T-shirt. And she wasn't happy about that, but I stuck to that. But that just illustrates the sort of questioning and the sort of assistance that the media were getting under Holt, which they would never have got under Menzies. So there were big changes there, and I found that when Holt became Prime Minister, there were about 3,000 letters came in congratulating him on his appointment. They came from everywhere, you know, kings and queens and presidents, and you know, down to Joe Blow in the street. And I sorted these letters out into four or five categories, I drew up a draft and a response to each category.
Frank, we did.
Oh, we did this one.
This,
okay, well, that's, I didn't know whether I mentioned this in the recording, but
it was quite indicative. Wasn't
yeah, well,
it, that that's, he wanted that, to reply to each one
personally. That's fine. Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, let's cut that one. But it did mean, from my point of view, that I couldn't. I found it more difficult preparing responses for Holt than I did with Menzies in terms of my work. That sort of indicates some of the changes in the styles, I think, of the two prime ministers.
You mentioned that, you know, you had about 2 hours together at that first meeting. What were other changes? Were there other changes that you can talk about apart from the media, though that's very important, obviously, and it was a lasting change, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, well, I think it was in the terms of how you respond to correspondence and stuff too, how he wanted to be seen. He wanted to be seen as being different, so that, you know, any responses were not to be sort of in Menzies' style. Yeah, I just can't recall other specifics on that 2 hour session, but it was mainly drumming into me that, you know, things are different now. It's a different regime, and you know, don't assume that, you know, the past carries on.
What was his tone like when he was saying all this?
Oh, friendly.
Yeah.
Oh yes, yeah. There was no aggro. It was just, you know, letting me know that this is the way he wanted the office to be run.
And he was, I mean, symbolically, he was very different to Menzies, wasn't he? Or that was the impression.
Yes, yes, he certainly was. And he certainly liked to be liked. And this had to come through in the correspondence as well. I remember I made one particular blunder in relation to some of this handling of correspondence with Holt that I recall. He used to take his holidays up Bingle Bay, where he had a property up in North Queensland, and he was very friendly with the local people up there. I recall there was a letter from one of the people from up there suggesting they were going to subpoena the Prime Minister on some particular issue, land issue. And I just tossed that aside, you know, subpoenaing prime ministers on land issues, pushed that aside.